Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Hamza Foy with Ihya 502 Podcast. In this episode, I'm going to be interviewing my wife, Mishkat Suleiman, who is a senior IT compliance professional at Humana. This episode is going to be about cybersecurity and our daily lives. I'm going to go ahead and let my wife take it away.
Awesome. Yes, assalamu alaikum, everyone. I'm so excited to be doing this episode. You can ask Hamza. I've been wanting to do it for months and months and months now. So it's long overdue at this point. So we can go ahead and get started. So I know what you're thinking. Cybersecurity, that's something that big companies have to worry about. Why are we talking about this? And it's true. Cybersecurity is extremely vast. But it's very, very easy to apply it in your own life. It's very easy to have that context in everything that you do. Why? Because the records are not stored in dusty file cabinets anymore. They're not up on a shelf. They're not on cassette tapes anymore. They're not on CDs. Well, sometimes they are. Now everything is in the cloud. It's on the internet. It's going through, you know, Wi-Fi and cellular networks and all kinds of really new technologies. And so all of your information, more than you ever thought you put online, is now all over the world because all of that information is routed through so many countries, jurisdictions, everything. So it's really important to figure out what you can do as an individual. And so, you know, when you're a big company, you can afford the cybersecurity. You can afford to have a whole department, a whole team of hundreds of people. And even with that, you've got so many companies that have had so many breaches. Mm-hmm. And what is a breach? A breach is when an attacker gains unauthorized access to your system, when information is leaked to where it's not supposed to be. Anything bad that can happen to your system that causes loss of data, loss of privacy, loss of confidentiality, loss of control would be considered a breach. So for context, we all heard about the Sony breach that cost them $100 million in program and processes, procedures, paying people for, you know, loss of value, whatever harm was incurred to customers. Anthem Insurance, $100 million. Heartland Payment Systems, $140 million. And then the really big one, which I don't think got too much publicity, was Epsilon. And a lot of people don't know what Epsilon is. So all the marketing emails that you get from, you know, they can be like from any company. It's not always that company kind of tailoring them and sending out. What they do is they contract other companies to market for them and then they don't have to worry about it. So Epsilon is a major, major marketing company and they deal with, you know, sending out marketing emails. Who are their customers? Chase Bank, Citibank, U.S. Bank, Best Buy, Visa, Amex, huge, huge companies that have given data to Epsilon, and Epsilon got hacked. So all of that data and all of the customers was leaked. How much did that cost? $4 billion, billion with a B. So it's a big deal. But the thing is, these huge companies, I mean, I hate to say it, they can afford this. They can afford this loss because they pay millions of dollars in insurance in case this happens where they have to send out restitutions. Us as individual people, we can't afford that because a breach like that in our social security, our credit card, passwords could mean that all of our bank accounts are wiped out. Our credit history, our credit score, our credit worthiness is wiped out. People can open loans in your name. So it's very, very important. And so, you know, a lot of people think, how can I even begin? And so it's not easy, but you can boil it down to three areas of our lives that are, you know, the most pervasive, which is our emails and phone numbers, our credit cards, and our passwords. So those are the three areas that I'd like to focus on today.
Okay. So to kind of circle back, we use this term data, and I want you, if you can, to get into more detail of what that word is being used to represent. I think for a lot of people, okay, they're familiar with like, okay, passwords. Okay, I got to make sure I have a complicated password. But like what other data is out there that could be breached. Could you get into that a little bit?
Any piece of information about anything is data. Your email is data. Your phone number is data. Mm-hmm. Passwords are data. What you put on Facebook, Instagram, pictures, keywords, when you tag locations and you tag people and you make that connection, I'm in this picture with this person, that is data. Anything. So your health records are data. All of those are now kept electronically. There are vast electronic medical record systems, EMR systems that handle all of your medical data. You have financial data, your social security number, your national identifier number, your passport number. All of that is data that people can use. And these are like the big things. I mean, people, you put a picture of your dog, your cat. I have birds. You put a picture of that and you put their name and you say, hey, this is Fluffy. That is data that a hacker can use. Anything about you that a hacker can use, where you were, when you were there, do you go there often? Do you check in? Your routine, what you throw out in the trash, your bank statements, your old credit cards, your receipts of what restaurants you like to eat at. All of that is data. Scary, huh?
You know, because kind of going through like this development boot camp, we're told about the importance of having like complicated passwords. Like, okay, you have like a single noun as your password, birthday or robot. Okay, that's something easily somebody could go in, develop a program that will just run through a dictionary list. Just throw it out there. Okay, I've got your password. And what's interesting is I made this connection. Perhaps this is a bad connection, but the fact that you mentioned, like, okay, what you put out there on Facebook, what you put out there on Instagram, like important things, like, okay, your spouse, your family, your pets. I feel like maybe I'm going down the rabbit hole, but I feel like good hackers would take that information. And they'll be like, maybe he based his password off of this, like his pet lizard.
Exactly. No, that's the thing, is that hackers have the time and the resources to go down that very rabbit hole. I mean, if they want, so you can have like two different types of attacks. You can have a targeted attack. You can have like a mass generic attack. And, you know, depending, a mass attack could be very costly to a company. A targeted attack would be very, very costly to an individual. Because this bad actor, we call them bad actors in the IT industry as well. The hackers are bad actors. This bad actor, you know, can sit down. They know all of your profiles, what social medias you have, where are you active, what do you have accounts with, and they will build that separate profile for you. They will build a profile with all of that information, and then they've got some very state-of-the-art, really malicious equipment that they can use to start. There's a term that we use called brute forcing, where they try and gain access to your password. And it basically is, if they have certain pieces of information about you, they might get lucky, maybe guess your password. If it's that insecure that you've used common identifiers, like password 123 is not a secure password, don't use it. Hello 123 is not a secure password, don't use it. Your pet's name, your birth date, your spouse's birth date, your wedding anniversary, none of those are secure passwords because they are all public knowledge. Your social security number is not a good password, because that is also, unfortunately, public knowledge. So, yes, they target it, but if they just can't crack it, they put it through a piece of technology that just cycles through every combination of every letter, every number, every special character. And if your password is like five characters, only five letters, they can guess that in a few hours. Of every combination possible.
So I guess for the layman, what are some pieces of advice that you have particular to password security? And then you can kind of dive into credit card security as well.
Yeah. Let me start by saying this. There's an organization called NIST, and I don't want to get too technical, but this organization called NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, I believe is what the acronym stands for. But basically they put out guidelines. They publish guidelines for the United States. They publish guidelines on cybersecurity for the government, for huge companies and people. That's like the gold standard nationally. NIST guidelines really are what drive password requirements in a lot of places. So, you mm-hmm. know, when you have passwords with Google and Microsoft and mm-hmm. companies or Amazon, all these big, big companies, they ask you for a long password with a lot of mm-hmm. characters, with a lot of special characters. It can't be your username. It can't be your birth date. It can't be your name, mm-hmm. all of that. Recently, what NIST did, because the thing is, the publications are always changing. So in the past, it was like, it's better to have a complex password with a really good combination of uppercase letters and lowercase letters and characters and question marks and all of that stuff. They recently changed their guideline to say that, yes, all that complexity is good, but a longer password is better. So instead of having just a one-word password with a few little bings and bangs here and there, mm-hmm. have a phrase, have a sentence as your password, because that is easy to remember for you. Mm-hmm. It gives you context, right? Mm-hmm. When you are constantly having to change your password over and over again, mm-hmm. you just want to keep making the easiest password possible because you have to remember it. And the best practice is have a different password for each website. Why? Because if you're using the same email, which we're going to talk about emails and phone numbers, mm-hmm. and you use the same password at each website, remember, we already know that these hackers and bad actors, they know where you have accounts. If you have the same password for your bank account and your credit card and your insurance, all of that you just lost control of just because you had one password. So do not have one password across multiple websites.
Can I cut in real quick?
Yeah.
Just for the listeners, just because I want to kind of clarify some of the terminology. Terminology you and I are familiar with, mm-hmm. but maybe the listener.
Yeah.
We say like characters or meaning...
numbers and letters.
Numbers and letters. Special characters are going to be anything that you can type on a keyboard that's not numbers and letters. Mm-hmm. So exclamation, the pound key, the dollar sign, that sort of thing. Just want to clear that up.
Yeah. Right. If you look at, so some websites, when you generate a password, they'll tell you like, this is not a sufficient password. Mm-hmm. It's weak. You only have, you know, you just have one word, or you only have like letters of the alphabet. So you need to add a number. You need mm-hmm. to add an exclamation point or a question mark or mm-hmm. the at symbol. That's a big one, or the dollar sign. Mm-hmm. So a lot of companies, they'll put their password guidelines before you make the password so that you mm-hmm. know what you need to incorporate. Mm-hmm. But as I said, so NIST realized that all of this, you know, nitpicky stuff, it makes it hard for people to remember their passwords, and they don't like that. And we know that we are human and we make mistakes and we like to make things easy on ourselves. So it's better to have a long phrase that you can remember, because the longer a password you have, the amount of time that it takes just to brute force as and crack it by going through all the combinations, it grows exponentially. Mm-hmm. So if you go from a 8-character, 8-letter mm-hmm. password to 10, I mean, that's like a difference of years of taking it to crack, because you've added so many more possibilities and combinations. Mm-hmm. So that would be my two biggest pieces of advice. Do not use the same password across multiple sites. Mm-hmm. Make your passwords into passphrases. That's what it's called when you have a sentence, or like a phrase is a password phrase, passphrase. That is unique to you. It means something to you, you know, nobody else. And don't have public information mm-hmm. as your password.
And another thing to kind of add in, like on the developer's end, a lot of the websites, a lot of the applications that you may be using, don't expect the developers on their end to make it to where it's going to force you to build, like what you said, a passphrase. Because mm-hmm. oftentimes...
Yeah.
The best I've seen it is maybe Google mm-hmm. is, you have to have an upper letter, then some lowercase mm-hmm. letters, a number, and a special mm-hmm. character.
Yeah.
But oftentimes, I mean, I hate to say it, but a lot of developers, we don't think about security enough.
Yeah. Sites that think that they're benign, which means that sites that think, the service we're giving you, you know, we're really not taking that much information from you. It's just your email address. Like it's, you know, or maybe you made an account with a website. You know, you're only going to use it once. You don't care. It's a quick thing. Those types of sites, they're not going to have all these guidelines built in. Because unfortunately, there's no, I mean, like I mentioned NIST. It's just guidelines.
Yeah.
Companies don't have to do this. There's no law that says you must or you're going to face penalties. Yeah. So.
No, that's the same thing from like what I've learned as I've learned to develop in JavaScript and now in C# is a lot of guidelines, mm-hmm. nothing enforced.
Mm-hmm.
So you as a user of these products online, you're going to have to hold yourself to that higher standard of building, like you said, a passphrase.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be forced on you because it's not forced on the developers.
Right.
So we got into password security. Now let's jump into credit card security if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So credit card security is my bread and butter at Humana. That is what I do. I ensure that our systems that process credit cards, anything that touches credit cards is secure. So you can apply that, you know, to your own cards as well. So first thing I want to mention that's very, very important. If you look at the credit cards that you have in your wallet right now, you're going to see a logo that either says Visa, Chase, Amex, MasterCard, or Discover. These are the big five card brands. Mm-hmm. And these big five card brands, they own that card.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they own everything, all the information about that card. If they ask you, I want that card back, you have to give that card back to them. Because they literally own it. So, you know, you might be banking with Fifth Third, you might be banking with US Bank, it doesn't matter. Those cards are owned by those five banks that I just mentioned. And we call them the big five card brands. And these big five card brand companies came up with a huge standard of how to keep credit cards safe for companies. And so if a company that takes credit card payments from customers, if they don't follow these standards, they start out by fining them very, very heavily. And if, you know, that doesn't work to get them compliant with the standard, then they'll just say, you know what? You can't process our cards anymore. Again, because they own those cards. So as an individual, there's a few things that you can do to make sure that your credit card number is safe. You know, the credit card realm is evolving. Some places you don't have to swipe a card. You don't have to insert it into the chip reader. You tap it or you wave it, you know, you dance around with it, whatever. You know, while that's very, very convenient, unfortunately, it makes it that much easier for a person to steal the credit card information. Why? Because cards that work like that, remotely or, you know, not physically, they emit an RFID, radio frequency ID. So it's basically like a signal that's coming out of the card itself. So what a bad actor can do, they have software, they have equipment. If they're standing near you, they just turn it on and they can steal that credit card information. So if you notice on your credit card, you have like a black stripe that goes across the back of it. That black stripe has a lot of sensitive information. And companies are not allowed to store this. In fact, it is like non-compliant, able to be penalized. You cannot store that sensitive information.
Okay.
What a bad actor can do from like a radio frequency coming from your card, they can collect that information. They can literally paste that information into like a fake plastic card because they make like fake plastic cards. So basically they've like cloned your credit card.
Wow.
They've taken the information virtually. They put it on a physical card that they have. It could be like a cheap gift card or whatever. And now they can use it as your card.
Now, would this apply for debit cards or is this strictly for credit cards?
No, but you can run any debit card as a credit transaction.
True.
Right? You don't have to provide a PIN number. It can be a credit transaction. So that's why this applies for both credit and debit cards. So, of course, credit cards, they're tied to your credit account, right? It's not money that you have. It's money that you have to pay off. It's kind of like on loan. A debit card is tied directly to your bank account, directly to your cash funds, your checking, your savings account. So that's my tip number one. Really avoid using your debit card anywhere. All right. I understand at the ATM, you have to stick it in. And I'm going to talk about, you know, security for sticking your credit card in anywhere. But if you can avoid using your debit card, that would be so much better for you. Because here's the thing. When you make a credit card transaction on a credit card, it takes a little while for that transaction to pop up on your credit account, right? And in that time, it gives you a little bit of time where you're like, wait, this isn't my transaction. It gives you time to contact your credit card provider and say, hey, freeze this, right? And I'm going to get into that a little bit more. But number one, try to avoid using your debit card. Okay, so the second thing is, you know, using your credit card. Now, I know we have a largely Muslim audience. So a lot of people, you know, we're not supposed to have interest. A lot of credit cards, the way they work is you can have the credit card. If you pay off the full amount of charges, you're not going to be charged interest. So in that way, we are allowed to have credit cards. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not a mufti. I'm not, I don't have a fatwa or anything. But if you're not accruing interest because you haven't paid off what you charged, you can have a credit card. And so that's, you know, how our credit card works is we pay it off and, you know, essentially we have it to build credit. Because if you don't have a loan account, you're not building up your credit score. If you're not building up your credit score, then I mean, you know, a lot of things. Maybe you don't care about it. Who knows? But the second thing that I want to talk about is, since we are using our credit cards and we're avoiding using our debit cards, when you go to a gas station or you go to your ATM, and any place that you have to stick your credit card in physically, stop, pause, and take a look. And you can, I do this every time. I do this every time at a gas station, at an ATM. The piece where I have to stick my credit card in, I'll just kind of grab it and I'll jiggle. Just very gently, I'll just kind of jiggle it. If it's loose, or even more scarily, if it comes off in my hand, I know that this is a device that somebody has stuck on top of the receptacle where the credit card's supposed to go.
Yeah.
Now, your credit card will pass through that additional device. It'll still go into the ATM or wherever you're wanting to put your credit card. And you will still be able to make that transaction. But that middle device that's not supposed to be there will steal your credit card information while you're using your card. The other thing that a lot of ATMs especially are vulnerable to is cameras. If you look around your ATM, there should not be a camera pointed at the PIN pad. Because when we use an ATM, what do? We put in a PIN number to use our debit card.
Yeah.
Right? If you have a camera pointed at the PIN pad and you have a jiggly device that's where the card's inserted, now they have your card number, they have your PIN number. And maybe they can see the screen too, and they can see how much how much money is in your bank account.
Gotcha.
You lost all of it.
So real quick, you mentioned these little card skimmers that can be attached
to gas stations,
ATMs. Would those also affect debit cards, or are those strictly targeting credit cards?
They can affect any card.
Okay.
Yes, gotcha.
I just
want to
make sure for these.
Any card at all. Gotcha. And it's not just, you know, now they're really nifty and they make these skimmers where they can. So think about like when you go to the grocery store, you have like this full pin pad of cards. You can swipe the card. It has like a big old screen where it sends you messages like, hit the enter button. Do you want cash back? And there's a full keypad of like numbers, and you have pressed the star symbol and the enter and everything. Skimmers, people who make these devices have also made devices that overlay on top.
Oh, of the keypad.
Of the keypad itself. So when you press the numbers, it steals that information. When you swipe the card, it steals that information. It's really ingenious. It's if you go and search online, just search credit card skimmer. You will, it will show you pictures of what an actual credit card device is supposed to look like, the dimensions, kind of like how thick the edges are and everything. And then it'll show you like, this is what it looks like with a skimmer on. And it's a very, very subtle difference, but it's there. So if you ever put your credit card in somewhere and you think, that kind of went in a lot more, like there's very little of the credit card sticking out or less than normal, then you probably stuck your card into a skimmer because it added just a little bit of depth.
So are there any other things that listeners can kind of look out for to ensure their credit card information is secure, or even like their debit card bank information is
bank secure? Yeah, there's, well, so for the physical card itself, and I'm really glad you asked this question. For the physical card itself, they make RFID blockers. So they make little metal containers and metal sleeves and sometimes even paper sleeves that have, it's like, I don't want to get into it too much, it's like a Faraday cage, basically. It blocks anything from coming out of your card while you're not using it and anything from getting into your card. So you can have like these little sleeves that you can keep in your wallet. It's essentially like, it's like a mosquito screen, you know, keep the mosquitoes away, but you can't, you know, you can't see it. That's number one. Number two, your bank has, you know, whether it's a credit card or a debit card, your bank has a very vested interest in making sure that your credit card information is not stolen. Because when your card information is stolen, someone makes a whole bunch of purchases and you say, nope, this was not me. Well, guess what? that bank is going to have to reimburse. That's a lot of money that they lose. There's an interesting thing that some banks do. So say you have a debit or credit card account, right? You have a card. And, you know, these banks, they know your address. So they know, like, typically the city that you live in is like, you know, we're in Louisville, Kentucky. So this is kind of our stomping ground all around Louisville. We're swiping our cards. And we also have our phones now. And we have banking apps on our phones. And these banks know this. And so they're tracking your location by your phone. Now, say someone from California came to Louisville. This is really, this is out there, okay? But just an example of like the capability that we have here. Someone from California came to Louisville. They put a skimmer or a, you know, some type of a credit card stealing device somewhere. And they stole your credit card information. And it transmitted back to them in California because it's virtual. Everything's virtual. Nobody has to be physically anywhere anymore. So your credit card information got stolen from Louisville, Kentucky, again, examples, out to California. And that's where the bad actor, the hacker, is. And he copied your credit card information onto a credit card. And it's almost, it's like exactly like having your actual card. And he purchases something worth $1,500, you know, in San Francisco, California. Now, you are in Louisville. Your bank knows you're in Louisville because it's tracking you through your phone. They know your address is in Louisville, and they're going to see that charge and they're going to say, why are you in Louisville and your card's being swiped in California? They're going to stop that charge from going through. That is the capability that cybersecurity programs at banks have. So why am I talking about this? Investigate what security measures your bank has for your cards. And the first thing that you should learn how to do is freeze your card or report it lost or stolen. Because none of this is perfect, right? A really determined person can steal whatever they want to steal. So prepare for the event that that happens while you're trying to prevent it. Figure out, how do I stop any transactions online, in store, whatever, international, national, how to stop it. First and foremost, figure out what your bank dispute processes are. If you're trying to look for a bank or trying to find a new bank, look for banks that have really good policies around, you know, if your card has been breached, we'll reimburse you for whatever amounts were processed. But really just be smart about where you're putting in your credit card information. And what I'm about to tell you now is going to be like the most technical thing that I say about credit cards when you, and this applies to like online, because we've talked about the physical skimmers and everything. When you go to a website where you're putting in your credit card number, if you look in the address bar where like the website's name and it's like www.chase.com, there is a lock symbol on the very left before any of the words, the HTTP starts. Look for that lock symbol. If you see that lock symbol, that means that any information you're entering in on that page online is being transmitted very, very securely. It's encrypted. So even if someone steals it, they can't see it because it's completely locked away. So if you do not see that lock symbol, do not enter in any information.
Now you're talking about the HTTP versus HTTPS.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know if I should, you know, get it being that technical, but if a website, So HTTP and HTTPS is basically how something is transmitted over the web, right? To just like break it down to its basics. So HTTP was the old standard. HTTPS is secure. That's what the S stands for. Hypertext Transfer Protocol, secure. So the S, you don't get that lock if there's no HTTPS. If it's just HTTP, you won't have that lock.
Yeah, I know most browsers nowadays, you're using Google Chrome, Safari on your phone, Mozilla Firefox, even Microsoft Edge.
Oh, yeah.
I think oftentimes they will have that symbol, the lock symbol, but definitely just for listeners, like any website you go to, even before the www.google or .amazon, there's always going to be either HTTP, which is unsecure, or HTTPS, which is secure. Also, you know, you might have like sites, because this is, I've done this before, where I've developed a site, but then I would pass on any transaction to like Stripe, for example. Mm-hmm. Like payment platforms that, once again, those are secure, the HTTPS. But yeah, just the address bar, you know, it's like top, probably the center, top center on whatever browser you're using, whether it's on your computer or phone.
Yeah.
Just look for that HTTPS. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's secure.
And there's a number of, you know, if you're really kind of slightly, if you want to take it the next level, if you're maybe a little bit more savvy, you can enable a lot of tools and capabilities and functionality on your browser that says, you know, it kind of scans what you're about to go to, and it'll send out an alert and say, this is not a secure website. Are you sure you want to go? And they'll ask you that several times before you're like, yes, let me go.
Yeah.
And typically you shouldn't. Sometimes
yeah, no,
we
they'll,
do.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. And honestly, I mean, I don't have my browser set up specifically to do that, but there'll be like websites maybe developed and like hosted on like GoDaddy, but it'll still throw out unsafe certificate, which is, you know, it's just a warning. Hey, don't do any transactions on this website. If you're just going to this website just to get information, I mean,
right. To read information, yes, but to interact with the site, to give information, definitely be very wary of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the third topic, and I know this is a broad umbrella, feel free to jump in and talk specifically, but social engineering.
Social engineering. Oh my goodness. So we can think about social engineering in the context of human value. There's a saying that at a lot of companies, people are our greatest asset. And it's so true because no machine can think the way that a person thinks. However, people can also be the weakest link. Why? Because we are human. We do not run on an algorithm. We do not do the same things the same exact way every day at the same exact time. God knows the pandemic has made routine fly out the window. I mean, yeah, sure, we can get out of bed at 1 o'clock in the morning, in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So people are vulnerable. People are unfortunately arrogant. People are forgetful and absent-minded. And people have a lot of pressure. So all of those things makes us susceptible to social engineering. What is social engineering? Social engineering is essentially playing on your humanity to get information. So I'll give you an example. And this happens a lot with, really doesn't happen so much over the phone anymore. Because now people have realized that the repeated phone calls about your vehicle's extended warranty that is expired are bogus. I received a call about 2 years ago, and I think it was the first time that I had received this type of call. And there was, it was an automated message, and it said, your social security number has been suspended. Your social security number will never be suspended. The Social Security Administration and the IRS do not do that. And I was like, this is interesting. I've not heard this one before. So I followed the prompts and everything, you know, press one to speak to a representative now. So I did all that, finally got to, you know, people. Yeah. And it was a man on the other line. He said, yes, I'm looking at your, and I didn't give them my number, by the way.
Yeah.
They may have already had my number because, again, Equifax was breached. Everybody's social security numbers are just out there.
Yeah.
So they may have my number tied to my phone. I didn't give it to them. I didn't repeat it to them because that's social engineering part one. Could you just confirm the last four digits of that number for me?
Yeah.
I didn't give them the number. I said, yeah, you know, I got this really funny call about my social security number being suspended. And they said, yes, we see that your social security number was, it was involved in a illegal drug transaction in Texas, south of the border. And I was like, wow, that is so oddly specific.
Yeah.
I was trying not to laugh. I was like, you know, I pretended to be very concerned. I was like, oh my God, like, what do I do? I didn't do this. Like, am I going to go to jail? And he's like, no, you're going to have to pay a pretty hefty fine. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And he said, so how much money you got in your bank account?
Wow.
And I'm just like cracking up over the phone. I said, I don't know, buddy. You tell me. How much do I have? Apparently, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I want to inform you that you could be fined up to $8,900. I was like, okay, this is good. You don't know how much I have in my bank account. That's great. So, you know, At that point, I was just like, I slammed the phone. I was like, this is so stupid. But this is how they prey on people who might not know what's happening, right? Your social security number has been suspended. If you're an elderly person who relies on social security checks, you're panicking. Yeah. Right? You don't know any better. So it's like, let me talk to a person. Let me straighten this out. Because deep down, most of us are good people. Mm-hmm. We want to be on the right side of the law.
Yeah.
We don't want to do things the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
But bad actors know that they can prey on our fear and our empathy, right? So you see GoFundMe sometimes. And this isn't really cybersecurity, but this is social engineering.
Yeah.
Someone could be lying and say, you know, God forbid, my mother has cancer and I need money for so-and-so surgery. You don't know, but you're an empathetic, sympathetic person. Mm-hmm. And you say, you know, maybe this is a scam, but here's $100. And if it is a scam, it is what it is. But if it's not a scam, then I've contributed, you know, pretty significantly to something. So that's one type of social engineering now, and that's more like human-tailored social engineering, right? Mm-hmm. The social engineering that we see today comes largely through our emails, and now it started coming through text messages on our phone. Why is that? Your email and your phone number now. Because now, you know, before people would have different phone numbers all the time. You're switching phones and plans, and, you know, when you switch from Verizon to T-Mobile, you can't keep the same number. Now, all these numbers can be like automatically ported company to company. You can keep that number forever. And bad actors, hackers, they know this. So your phone number and your email has now become basically the identifier of your online identity. Everybody has an online identity. The most basic piece of information that any company, any entity is going to ask for is either your email or your phone number.
Yep.
Our emails and our phone numbers are commodities that companies sell and trade and privatize and deprivatize. And no, we'll never sell it. But, you know, except for in this situation, it's already sold, right? So everywhere is our email address and phone number. And so that's why you see all these emails saying, you know, reset your bank account password. It's been breached. Click this link. Do it now.
Yeah.
They try to panic you. Because when you panic and you're stressed out, you don't think about things critically. You don't notice that that particular email has really poor spelling or the logo is like blurry because they copied and pasted it from the internet. So that is how social engineering works. What I just described with the emails is something called phishing, because they fish for your information. They dangle the, you know, either you won something, click on this, or, you know, they dangle the fear hook. You're about to be screwed. Do something. And they wait for you to grab onto it so they can reel out whatever information they can get. And so that's called phishing. And phishing is a form of social engineering. So that's probably like the least technical part. But again, the information that you provide is very, very technical. It's stored in a very technical way. It's processed in a very technical way. And it's used by both legitimate companies and bad actors in a very, very technical way. So that's usually the biggest part of cybersecurity. And a good chunk of money is spent by these big companies to train their employees on how not to fall for a phishing or a social engineering campaign.
Now I get emails all the time at work, and it's always like, do this training because we want to make sure you're not clicking any suspicious links, that sort of thing. Which for me, I'm pretty critical of anything that I get from, you know, via email. But you were talking about like people who use social engineering, they play on like fear and empathy. And I also think, especially in particular for our community, the Muslim community, they also play on just lack of knowledge. You know, you have somebody who may have like immigrated here recently. They don't know our laws. They don't know. They have no knowledge of what is all the laws pertaining to social security numbers, for example. Because you were mentioning, you know, the social security number suspended. Okay, yeah, you and me were like, that never happens. That doesn't make sense. But once again, somebody else, oh God.
This well, that's like... the thing is, like, to me as an immigrant, the first, you know, the first time that I got that call. So that incident that I was describing about the whole drug deal in Texas, I got really frustrated. I was like, I'm annoyed at this point because the phone was constantly ringing.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? I'm just going to like waste 30 minutes of their time because why not? You know, their time that I'm wasting is like taking time away from scamming somebody who might actually fall for it.
Yeah.
So the first time that got that call years and years ago, before I ever started working at Humana, gosh, maybe I was in college, maybe I was in high school, you know, but like I am an immigrant. And so the first time that I got that call, I was like, what do you mean? My social security number has been, what are you like kicking me out of this country?
Yeah.
You know, so it's very, very concerning. Yes, when you are new, but that's the thing. Is like in this context, I mean, everybody gets those voice recordings, your social security number, your car's warranty.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, like, you know, a little bit longer ago, like maybe in the 2000s, people were getting like targeted phone calls from actual human people. There's another story I could tell. I don't know if we have time, So I'm not going to mention any names, but I have a friend, a very, very dear friend. And her daughter went off to college. She and I are sitting there, you know, her daughter's in college in another state. And, you know, she's planning a party and I'm helping her. And, you know, we're going to go to the grocery store later. So perfectly normal day. She gets this phone call from a live man. And he identified himself as Deputy Sheriff Murphy. I remember this. I remember this idiot's name. And this was when I was in college. And he said, Your daughter missed a jury duty summons.
Ooh.
And she has a bench warrant out for her arrest. She will be arrested the next time she sets foot in Kentucky. And so, of course, I'm sitting next to her mother. Her mother just freaked out, right?
Yeah.
A bench warrant for missing jury duty. Nah. and so this character tells her, you need to pay a $2,000 fine.
Oh, Lord.
And... you know, so her mom is like freaking out. And so, you know, we race over to the bank and we tell the bank because like she's crying and everybody's like, what's wrong? Like, is there a gunman in the parking lot or something? Like, what's happening? And she described the incident. They're like, we're not giving you the money. They would not let her withdraw that money out of her bank account because they're like, this is so scammy.
Yeah.
So scammy. But that's the thing. Like, it could be anytime, anywhere. And this was 2012, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So as early as 2012, they were doing targeted phone calls. This person that called my friend's mother knew that my friend was in college in a different state. She was not at home. And her mail was scattered across two different addresses because she has a college address and her parents' home address.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that it was very likely that some piece of mail could be missed somewhere. And so he concocted a lovely story of missing jury duty. And now she's going to be arrested. So it can be targeted. And when it's targeted, it's extremely scary. But here's what I'm going to say. Your bank will never call you. They will send you letters and say, call us. And sometimes they provide you the number. Sometimes they direct you to the website. They will never call you. They will never email you and ask you to do something in an email where you click or download this. They will never do that.
Mm-hmm.
A bank account will never do that. You know, your Social Security Administration will never do that. So that's one thing to look for. If there's like a very urgent call to action, do something in the email, take a pause.
Yep.
Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with attachments. Right? We get excited to see emails with attachments. Ooh, somebody sent us something special. Don't click on them unless you know exactly who they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Because that attachment could blow a hole wide open, virtually, of course, in your laptop. And what's on your laptop? You've got bank statements on your laptop. You've got your mortgage information on your laptop. You've got your credit card information on your laptop. You've got your birthdays and anniversaries and where your vacation home is and all this information on your laptop. Just sitting there waiting. Antivirus. That wasn't going to be one of my sections because it's very technical. Get antivirus for your laptops and phones.
And just for listeners, any call that you get that claims to be from like LMPD, always call LMPD's non-emergency talk to a sergeant, because 99% of the time that call's fake. Mm-hmm. They're always gonna go above and beyond to meet you in person. Sheriff's office, you know, when they serve summons or warrants or emergency protective orders, they'll call you to set up a time to meet with you in person. It's mm-hmm. never pay $2,000 over the phone.
No. And credit card Target gift cards. We like Target gift cards. Yeah. That's another thing that they'll do is go and get $2,000 and then buy 10 gift cards.
Yeah. All that is bogus.
For information, I think LMPD's non-emergency number is 502-574 LMPD.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Sheriff's Office, you can pull up their number online. Because Sheriff's Office is what handles like a lot of like the serving summons, serving warrants, EPOs, that sort of thing. But I can't tell you how many times we've had to deal with like fake spam calls from supposedly law enforcement. And that's another thing for listeners. Like, okay, you get one of these calls or get one of these emails, there is no harm in pausing mm-hmm. and verifying. Okay, they can make it seem as urgent as they want. Look up the number for LMPD or sheriff's office or whomever. Give them a call. Do what you have to do to verify. But don't like immediately, oh, I got to text back, or oh, I got to reply to this email. Oh, I got to open this attachment. Don't do that. So within the realm of social engineering, you talked a bit about phishing. Mm-hmm. Are there any other social engineering tactics that you've seen that may be something that just your average Joe might encounter?
That's the biggest one. You know, you can fish in a targeted way. Mm. Again, like I talked about, you know, you could send out companies to people who are CEO level or higher. They're very, very busy people. Oh, they look at the email. Oh, okay, let me just do this real quick, and they'll do it. So the biggest one really is phishing. But, anything can be social engineering. And it's not always like cybersecurity related, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you watch old heist movies, so I love telling this story. There's a movie called Catch Me If You Can. If, you know, you're Muslim, I don't suggest you watch the movie. I do suggest you read the book. The mm-hmm. movie is a little, it's a little raunchy, yeah. But the book is a very good book, and it's written by someone, his name is Frank Abagnale, and I had the pleasure of meeting him. He is, I think he's a convicted felon, honestly. He is a person who, you know, years and years and years ago, I think in the 80s, did check forgeries. And he came to Humana and he did a talk, and that's how I learned about him. Checks, you know, what does that have to do with cyber? Checks are physical, mm-hmm. right? And back then, of course, they were even more physical. But he was a person who flew around the world posing as a Pan American. Back then, you know, it was Pan American Airlines, as a Pan Am pilot. He started, I think, when he was 16 or 17 years old. So, of course, he was not old enough to be a pilot. He used smooth talking and, you know, very quick thinking, quick on his feet. Mm-hmm. And with just like a little bit of information, he posed as a pilot. He posed as a doctor, a surgeon, mm-hmm. not just a doctor, a surgeon. Mm-hmm. And he did it through social engineering because, you know, he either hurried people or he, you know, looked down at them like, what are you talking about? I'm the one who's right. Like, go do something, you know, just you have to be. It's just all a con, and a con comes from confidence. A con is someone who's completely confident that they can dupe you. I really suggest everybody read the book Catch Me If You Can, because some of the stuff, and it's based on a true story. He got caught in a French prison. French prisons back then were not good. He was extradited to the United States for sentencing and you know, trial and everything. He, I believe, did serve in jail before the FBI took him out and said, you need to help us with, you know, solving some of these check forgeries. And so he did. Uh-huh. And so now he goes around the country and he talks about his experience as someone who forged checks. There was somebody else that I met who used to work for the hacker organization Anonymous. He also got caught and now works for the FBI. Wow. So I don't suggest it. I'm not advocating doing criminal things in the hope that the FBI will recruit you. That doesn't always work. But that's the thing, is like social engineering, you know, can be as simple as, it can be as simple as like piggybacking, right? What is piggybacking? So say you live in a building or a community that's gated. You have to swipe a badge to get through. And somebody comes up to you, their arms are just like laden with stuff. Like, hey, can you just hold the door for me, please? I can't get to my card. And you're a nice person. Yeah, you'll hold the door for them.
Yeah.
You don't know who that is. Mm-hmm. You don't know if those huge boxes they're carrying are empty or just, you know, you just let a person through. You don't know if they have a key card to go through where they're not supposed to go through.
Yeah.
Wow. It can be anything. It social engineering is limited only by a person's ingenuity.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've also had an experience. Now it's non-virtual, but it's still, I feel like it was like social engineering. And actually it's something that happened in this community. And the reason I'm going to go through the story is to just kind of reinforce, especially when you're dealing with, once again, non-virtual social engineering. It's always important to know one another. And I feel like a lot of social engineering that may be virtual and non-virtual takes advantage of the fact that like people are more separated nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we had an instance, this was a couple years ago, this Muslim student at U of L, somebody reached out to him. He was also a student of U of L, and he was like, hey man, my dad is Muslim and he passed away in Mexico. We want to do a janazah here in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he was one of my best friends. He hit me up. He was like, yo, Hamza, you know, this is the story. He says, dad's Muslim. He's in Mexico and they want to bring him to Louisville to do a janazah. And I'm sitting here, but we have this system in place where it's like, okay, somebody passes away, which masjid does he go to or she go to?
Mm-hmm.
Who can say that they saw him or her?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't know you, right, then it's not our place to give you the janazah. Now, all the fiqh aside about like you shouldn't be shipping bodies over here and there to do janazahs, but right then and there is like that was our trust and verify right there. It's like, okay, have we seen this person at any of the masjids? Can you say that? No, let them bury him in Mexico, like right. not here in Louisville. But it's like, I feel like, especially for the non-virtual, like social engineering, like you mentioned, the, you know, holding the door open for so-and-so. Like if I'm at a masjid, you know, especially after what happened in like Christchurch,
mm-hmm.
you know, the mosque shooting,
yeah,
that was on our minds. Is like, okay, the person coming through the door, do we know you?
Right.
Okay. You're somebody who frequents the masjid. Okay, cool. Come in. And, you know, that was, so I feel like some of the social engineering tactics take advantage of the fact that we're so disconnected that it's kind of like our empathy has to be bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Cause we're just like, okay, I may not know this person, but I want to be nice. But it's like, if we were all more interconnected,
mm-hmm.
then it's harder for people from the outside to kind of get in, take advantage of us, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes, it does. Yeah. I mean, and it works from a social level. It also works on a professional level. You know, if you're a person who, you know, you have like a, you work in a grocery store or, you know, you work at Meijer, Kroger, Home Depot even.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe you don't know like the top levels of your company, which why would you at that point, you know, like I do, I know my direct report structure because, you know, corporate, like you kind of have to, but if you're just, you know, you're a person, you're working, you're doing your job, you're doing what you're supposed to, you know, why would you be getting an email from your CEO or your CFO or your, it's tough because you never know who is contacting you and who is legit and who is not. And so, you know, for me, it used to be trust, but verify. Now it's just like, don't trust, always verify. Because you have to, like some of the stuff that we see, you know, it's incredible. And it's because somebody got past all of the defenses and everything that have been put into place. I mean, you know, the companies that I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, Sony, Anthem, Heartland, Target, Equifax, these are not small players. These are giant companies.
Mm-hmm.
And if that can happen to them, it can happen to anybody, you know? And, you know, if you've got a hacker or a bad actor who is just starting out, chances are they're going to target individuals first. They're going to go after companies later, but they're going to target people and see how far can they get in that web? How far can they ingratiate themselves? You know, they could build a rapport with you by, you know, emailing you and corresponding you, catfishing. Catfishing. I forgot about catfishing. So let's talk about that rabbit hole a little bit. What is catfishing on social media? Right? And hopefully this does not impact like our communities as much because we're not supposed to have a dating scene.
Yeah.
But, you know, catfishing is someone pretending to be someone else on the other side of the computer. And you think you're talking to, you know, a very pretty girl. It turns out it's a dude living in his mother's basement.
That's a classical example, but I feel like there are instances of catfishing that's not related to any romantic endeavor.
No, it wouldn't be. Yeah. Catfishing can be a way for a bad actor, a hacker, to get information. It doesn't have to be romantic. They could be, you know, they'll be romantic to you, but that's not their end goal. You know, oh, you have a dog? What's his name? What's his breed? When did you get him? You know, tell me all about your dog. I just love hearing you talk.
It's more about building the profile on you, especially if they want to target you. Yep. I mean, any sort of relationship they can build,
they will build it. They'll build it because it's worth it to them. Mm-hmm. That amount of information is worth it to them.
I can imagine. Okay, they might find out about your family members, what pets you have, what hobbies you have. Okay, this might have something to do with his or her password. Mm-hmm. This might have something to do with his or her, you know, wherever they're putting their data.
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of close the conversation, are there any remarks or any other pieces of advice that you can give listeners?
There are. I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot. We talked about some of them, right? Mm-hmm. Always question. Don't trust. Always verify.
Mm-hmm.
There was one resource in particular that I wanted people to know about as far as emails, because, again, like I said, we use our emails as our online identity everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you don't even remember which websites you've made an account on using a certain email. Like, you know, it's a one-time thing. I'm done. You don't close the account. You don't deactivate it.
Mm-hmm.
So there is one resource. It's a website. It's called Have I Been Pwned, H-A-V-E, have I-B-E-E-N, been, pwned, instead of like owned, it's pwned, P-W-N-E-D. I don't know if you can put this like in the description or something.
I will.
Have I been pwned? You can enter in your email or your phone number, and it will search and see how many websites that you have an account on have been breached.
Huh.
So, you know, if you have your email registered with Target, with Chegg, it'll tell you, like, recent breaches that your email was exposed in.
Oh.
So it's a really cool tool. I suggest everybody try it.
Mm-hmm.
It is as secure as you can get. Have I Been Pwned? It's fun. Give it a shot. See if your email's been involved in any breaches, because it will tell you. But other than that, you know, don't make unnecessary accounts that you don't have to. I always prefer to check out as a guest if I can. That way they're not really storing not too much information. They will always store something.
You mean like a business transaction?
Like a business, purchases. like an online purchase. Gotcha, you know, sometimes when you buy something on a website, they require you to make an account with them. And I really, really hate that. It's good for like tracking purposes and it gives you an account history and a purchase history. But it's like, do you really need it, especially for a one-time purchase? Like I always use continue as guest. Yeah. I try not to make accounts.
I feel like the websites that require that, they also do that because of they want to track obviously your transaction history and your search history, because then they'll use that to tailor the front end, like what items show up first.
Yeah.
Like if you go online and you're buying a lot of makeup, well, here's even more makeup.
Right.
Like let's skip the sporting goods, let's skip the clothing. Here's more makeup. Mm-hmm. That's what they typically use that for.
It's really interesting. So a lot of people think like, oh, my phone is listening and all that. And yes and no. Yes and no.
Yeah.
A lot of that is based on where you are, your geolocation, and what you click on and what you search for. There was one, you know, somebody, I can't remember where this article was. It was really interesting, but they explained like, you know, they went and they stayed with their mother and, you know, their mother like purchased toothpaste that she likes to purchase. And now all of a sudden the other person is getting ads for this toothpaste. And it's not because they talked about the toothpaste, you know, because the person was like, I didn't mention that. We didn't talk about the toothpaste.
Yeah,
we just bought it.
Yeah.
And it's because their phone was in the same vicinity as their mother's phone, mm-hmm. where there was like the grocery app that tracked that she bought this toothpaste. And so the algorithm that all of this runs on thought, you know, you're connected to this person. Mm-hmm. You know, let's make toothpaste the talking point here, which it didn't know that it's toothpaste. You know, it's just like, it's, hey, here's something that, you know, you were close to. So a lot of it is based on geolocation. I mean, I'm not saying that our phones are not listening. They can be listening. But a lot of the information they get, they don't have to listen.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that a number of sites, what they'll do is, once again, they will just build a profile on you based on your search results, the websites you visited, and once again, your location. You know, I think, once again, like you were saying, they're like, oh, the phones are listening. It's like, they're listening not to your conversations, but what you're typing in, what you're clicking.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize how hard it is to parse audio, like actual like voice streams. It's very difficult for an automated kind of process to parse through that. But what they can parse through that's easy is your clicks and your views and how much time you spent. I mean, all of this information, and you know, you probably know about it better than I do. All this information is gathered as statistics on any website.
It's SEO. Yeah. They pay attention to how long you have a certain web page opened. Did you choose to scroll through it, or were you just at the top of the page?
And you moved off because you were like, I don't want this.
Exactly. Yet. They track that, and I think a lot of listeners have to realize that those are metrics that people use to determine if developed websites are high enough quality.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a giant feedback loop. Always, all the time.
Yeah.
And that's always on.
Any more?
We take more? I mean, you know, I could do like two or three whole separate episodes on all of this. And it would definitely get more and more technical each time we talked about it. But I mean, again, you know, to wrap it up, passwords, they have to be secure.
Yep.
People talk about moving away from the password model. One thing that we didn't talk about with passwords is multi-factor authentication. A lot of times at some websites, you enter in your password and then they say, hey, we're going to send you a text to your phone and enter in the code. And that's a really good thing to turn on. It's inconvenient, yes, but if it's your bank, if it's your you know, mortgage, if it's your insurance, if it's your healthcare, I would really suggest turning on multi-factor authentication. Setting long passwords, different passwords.
Passphrases.
Passphrases, right. Use whole sentences. That's really important. Credit cards, you know, try not to use your debit card. Be careful where you stick it in. Emails, you know, think before clicking, or to me it's like don't click, just don't do it. Right, if a website tells you, hey, you can click this link to go to our website, it's not going to take any more of your time to go open your browser and say, hey, I'm going to go to www.amazon.com. I'm not clicking on this hyperlink that may or may not take me, because a lot of times when you click on a link, it'll take you to a page that looks exactly the way it's supposed to. It's not. So you have to be careful about that. Just be very, very cognizant. We live in a very fast-paced world, and it's easy to it's easy to lose sight of what's legit, what's not legit. But if it sounds too scary to be true, if it sounds too good to be true, no, you did not win an iPhone. You did not win an iPad. Please don't click. And especially in text messages, because now I'm seeing that a lot. Do not click on anything you get in a text message. Sometime you will receive a random text message and you're like, wait, I didn't do anything. I haven't been on my phone in hours. Why? That is a phishing attempt. Don't click the link.
Also, just once again, anything that you get claiming to be a healthcare provider, claiming to be law enforcement, claiming to be the IRS... Once again, don't respond immediately. Reach back out to them. Verify, did you try to reach out to me this way? Because most likely their policy is, we're not going to get your information via text message or via phone call. You know, like I mentioned, LMPD, sheriff's office, they're going to do all they can to meet with you face to face. Once again, because their policy is, We need to meet face to face so that people know this isn't a phishing attempt. Mm-hmm. This isn't bogus. Mm-hmm. So don't be afraid to pause and say, hey, I'm going to reach back out to Norton Healthcare or the sheriff's office. Say, hey, is this legit? No? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing to keep in mind, yes, the world is fast-paced, but companies and corporations and governments, especially governments, are not. They give you a lead time of like at least a week to 30 days, maybe even like, you know, 2 to 3 months of response. So anything telling you, if you don't change your password, your account is going to be disabled in 3 days. No, that's not how it works. They will give you lead time because they need lead time, right? They need lead time because, you know, you could be one of like 50,000 customers that you need to change your password. You're not going to sit there and disable 50,000 accounts in one go. That'll crash their system. Not really. But, you know, just think about the fact, like, if something is telling you you need to respond urgently, that's the time when you need to slow down and think about it.
All right. I think this was an incredible episode.
It's jam-packed.
But you know what? We definitely need to do more episodes where we can go in more in depth.
Oh, yeah.
I think.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of rabbit holes. There's a lot of twists and turns that we didn't cover that I'd love to cover, but yeah.
Well, Jazakallah khairan. Thank you for tuning in to Ihya 502 Podcast. Once again, we're on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also click on the links in the description. I'll be including haveibeenpwned.com, most likely NIST guidelines.
That can get a little technical. I just mentioned them. Nope. I don't think that that's
cool.
I don't think that's needed.
Any other links related to our conversation we'll have in there. Also maintain a newsletter for the Louisville Muslim community, both through Substack. So that's going to be an email newsletter, as well as a WhatsApp group newsletter. Chat is disabled to save you guys from spam. Don't worry about that. I got your backs. As always, thank you for listening. Assalamu alaikum.